Okay, so I guess everybody's curious what this thing means. It's a Latin thing. It means either Caesar or nothing. And it means, so basically when, I think at some point the Roman soldiers were fighting or something, and they said, we either kill Caesar or we don't get anything, or we all. So, I mean, it's, and it illustrates, I think, very well what's happening here, because as you'll see in this polarization, in one case you get very nice physics, nice polarization, and really interesting things happening, and in all the other cases we don't get anything whatsoever. So that's the reason. So why would one want to study F1, D2 polarization? Well, first, it hasn't been done. Second, it's possible to do two descriptions for it. It's possible to describe it both using supergravity and using the matrix degrees of freedom of some brains. So it's a very interesting. Usually polarization is, most of the cases it's only described using supergravity. So in this case, we can describe it in two ways and you get the same result. And also, because the dimension of the D2 brain is one bigger than the one of the F1 string, one expects very interesting physics to happen, and let me show you why. And so one expects some very interesting phenomena to happen. So I'll first give an appetizer. I'll do an eye treatment of this polarization and show you how things are and why things should be interesting. And then we'll do the matrix description. And then we'll do the supergravity description. And then we'll comment on the results. So what is the setup? We have a bunch of fundamental strings on top of each other. Let's say we have n of them. And we want to pop them out into a D2 brain. Now, to pop them out into a D2 brain and for the D2 brain not to collapse, we need to have a non-trivial C3 field. The C3 couples with the D2 brain, so if the C3 is zero, the D2 brain just collapses to the origin and nothing polarizes. If the C3 is non-trivial, then the F strings, there's a potential, there's some force which keeps the D2 brain out, and maybe that force could help with the polarization. So basically, we want those strings to polarize into a tubular D2 brain, and if we call this direction, the F strings are in the 0 and Z, and we can call this X, and we can call this Y. So we want the D2 brain of this, with this geometry, and basically one needs a four field on the direction 0, X, Y, Z. And we can very easily treat this problem. We can just take an F 0, X, Y, Z to put a D2 brain with F string charge and find its potential. And I mean, this thing has been done by Roberto Imparani in 97, right before ADS-CFT. And the potential is not very hard to find. Basically, you just have 1 over G string times square root of R square plus G square N square. This is the Born introduction for this D2 brain, this circular D2 brain in this potential. And we have a minus. And then we have F, which is the absolute value of this field, times R square over G string again. So this is how the potential looks at first sight. And you can go ahead and expand it. Suppose you have a large number of strings, and this guy is bigger than this guy. We can expand it, and we get N, which is what one expects, plus R square over G square N minus F over G times R square. And now we see we have some problems, because first of all, so this is the expansion of this guy, and you can see that near the origin, if this F is large, there's a potential, yes?
I'm sorry, so the first line is the potential for a D2 brain?
Yes, so if you take a D2 brain with F string charge, with a large F string charge, which is encoded in here, so there's a large, basically the N F string charges. F string charge dominates the D2 brain charge, so the D2 brain charge is just there for the ride. And you can see that to obtain this type of thing, this potential is obtained by Imparan first, and it has some problems. So what it tells you is that if N is large, you need a very, very small field to just destabilize the solution. I mean, basically you have a large number of strings, you put a tiny F, 1 over N, or over the 1 over N, and basically these strings stop being a ground state of your system, they basically disappear from the spectrum. You don't have any more strings in the problem. And it's quite non-physical. I mean, I don't think it's a right result. The thing which was not taken into account and which people usually don't take into account too often is that in supergravity you cannot just turn on some F4 field. I mean, you cannot just turn on some field and expect nothing else to happen. This F4 back reacts on the graviton, on the dilaton, and on all the fields in the problem. So actually, because of this F4, of this non-trivial F4, there is another term in the problem, which is F squared times N times R squared, with some coefficient which we'll find later. And this term actually can stabilize the situation. If this term is very large, then I mean there's going to be no polarization whatsoever. And the exact coefficient of this term is very important for establishing what type of physics we have. Now you may wonder why it's only important here in this particular polarization case and why nobody talks about it. For example, if you read Meyer's paper on polarization, he only considers these two terms and he doesn't consider the last one. The reason is that when you have polarization into an object of dimension 2 or higher, this potential is up to the fourth R cube R squared. And the presence of an R squared term does not affect the fact that you have a ground state or not. I mean, it may affect where the ground state is, but it doesn't affect the physical thing, the physical presence of polarization. Well, here, this term is very important. I mean, basically, it tells you if you have polarization and if you don't, or if the brains decay. I mean, if this term is too small, the brains may as well decay. And so basically, this term is very important to find. Now, there are several ways of finding it. The brute force way is to take the F4 and just plug into the supergravity equation of motion, find the back reaction on the field. I mean, it has been done by Dizzy Friedman, and somebody else in the room tried, but it's quite a harsh computation, and I mean, it's not the easiest way to do. The slick way of doing it is to actually use supersymmetry. It's basically to look for a configuration where you can turn F4 in a supersymmetric fashion, and then use supersymmetry to compute the potential of this brain, and then say if you have four supercharges, the potential is a square, so actually I can just write down the coefficient of this term. And this is the way we'll use. Again, supersymmetry, you can find it two ways. We can either look for the supersymmetry preserved by the supergravity background, but again, it's a messy computation, it's 10-dimensional supergravity, I mean, with many forms, I mean, we have dilaton, b mu nu, I mean, all the nice guys. Or you can actually do it in a very tricky way. You can actually use an ADS-CFT type of duality to relate the supergravity background to some field theory with a perturbation, and then find out the supersymmetry in the field theory. The field theory is a two-dimensional field theory, very, very easy to examine, and say that, okay, based on the boundary theory, you have so many supercharges, and therefore the bulk will have the same number of supercharges. So this is actually the philosophy which we'll be using to find this this term. Okay, so much for the introduction. And you see this will be the subject of the last part of the talk. So now let's do the matrix description of this state. I think it's not, in the matrix description, this term will not be found because it's an F-square coupling in the matrix model, and those couplings are usually not known. But I think it's beautiful to see just how this configuration is described by matrices, and to see, I mean, it's a lot of interesting physics involved. So how might one describe this configuration of an F-string blown into a D2 brain? Well, first you may think, okay, we need matrix string theory to do it because we don't have any smaller D-brains. There is actually a trick which works, and this is the suggestion by Waddy Taylor, to put just a bunch of D0 brains, to just add them by hand, put them in the problem, along the F-string, and then use the D0 brains degrees of freedom, which are n by n matrices, to describe this state with a string charge and D2 brain charge. And then find the action and then take the limit on the D0 brains go to zero when the density goes to zero, and you're left without configuration. So you put the D0 brains, use their degrees of freedom to describe what's going on, and then you throw them out. So this description is actually not so hard. I mean, if you have n by n matrices, you can actually think about infinite. You just use infinite matrices because you are taking the limit when this dimension goes to infinity. The z-coordinate describes where the D0 brains are. You can see that they are like at minus 2, minus 1. So they are a distance n from each other. N is this distance. And the x and y coordinates are doing this funny thing. They have the coefficient r in front. So I mean, there's a state which is fuzzy, and it's kind of at the distance r. And they're also rotating. And you'll see that the rotation is very important because basically the rotation of of the validation of these coordinates is what gives F1 string charge. So how do you know what, so basically it's very important that those matrices are time dependent. We can very easily write down the string charge. It's Q in the, let's say, in the 0, z direction, which we have here. And this is proportional to the symmetrized trace of xi dot xi z commutator. And basically this is, I mean, this formula is defined first by Taylor and von Ramsdorff in the papers with D0 brains and weakly coupled fields. And so basically this is the string charge, and you see this xi dot is what gives you the string charge, and if you plug in those matrices into here, it's not a very hard computation, and you'll find that this is proportional to omega times r squared. So indeed, omega is the rotation, the more angular momentum you have, the bigger string charge you have. And the D2 brain dipole moment, so this is the D2 dipole, is proportional to, and we have three formulas, you have x, y, z commutator plus y, z, x commutator plus z, x, y commutator. This gives the dipole moment a direction x away from the origin in the yz plane, and this is indeed non-zero. So in the yz plane we have some cube, so we have a d2 moment. This gives the dipole moment in the a direction y away from the origin in the xz plane, and again I have d2 charge here, and both those are non-zero, and this gives the dipole moment in the direction z from the origin in the xy plane. And you see from this configuration we expect no D2 charge, and indeed x and y commutator from those things, we can work this out. Actually this is equal to zero. So indeed we get the right D2 charge, and we have the right F string charge. So I mean basically this configuration has the right charges, and is basically what describes this state. Let me make a side comment. This configuration was first found by Townsend and Mateos in a paper called Supercubes. They actually found this. They actually were looking for such a configuration of a D2 brain with F string charge and D0 charge. What's different here? There are two things. First of all, we are using the matrix model to find the Lagrangian, but here we want to take the limit when the D0 charge goes to zero. So D0 charge goes to zero, I mean, you cannot use the matrix model. I mean, basically, this is like an extreme limit, and actually we have to use the non-abelian Born-Winfeld action to find the action of this cube. So actually their configuration, their matrix description is only gives the right energy for very low F1 and D2 charge and very large D0 charge, which is exactly the opposite limit of what we have here. And also here we have F4, so we have another term in the action which takes into account the F4. So in the non-abelian Born-Winfeld action we define those Fs. That's how the action is, and again, this is from the paper by von Ramsdorff and Wadi Taylor, and it was also found by Myers. And this is the form of the Born-Winfeld action. Those are n by n matrices, and this determinant is a 4x4 determinant, and it's quite a messy expression. I mean, those are n by n matrices. The good news is that when one takes this determinant and takes all the possible orderings and so on, and one computes this determinant, there are some very nice properties, and for example x and y commute and so on and so forth. These properties actually simplify this determinant a lot, and the only matrix which is left in front of the symmetrized trace is actually the matrix x squared plus y squared, which is equal to 1. So actually the symmetrized trace doesn't even, I mean basically just gives you an n, and all the ordering is very, everything works out very, very nice. So this is one case where we are using a non-abelian Born-Winfeld in a very high field regime. The field is very high, and basically F is much, much larger than 1. But basically we are, but fortunately things are working out and are conspiring to give us a physical result. Usually the Born-Winfeld action, the non-abelian Born-Winfeld is quite hard to use in such a limit. But
is this known to be correct?
The non-abelian Born-Winfeld? Well, as far as I know, people have said that at the sixth order there are problems, and when they expand it in large F, they get problems. Here, actually, there are no problems because when you go to order 6, you see all the f's are just x's and y's, and that's what they commute. So actually you don't have anything at order bigger than 4. So somehow, even if the symmetric prescription is not wrong, is not right, and maybe there's another prescription which takes care of this f to the 6 terms, basically this problem is insensitive to those. I mean, basically we don't bump into those problems. I mean, basically this is some regime which we don't mess up with, because we have x squared plus y squared equals 1. So there's no non-trivial physics going on at order 6 in f. And also I'm getting the right result, as you'll see. I mean, basically this reproduces exactly the supergravity computation. I mean, all the numbers, I mean, even like the 2s and the pi's, I mean, I was quite amazed when I saw it happening. So, I mean, this is like one matrix, this is like matrix description, and the other one is just like a supergravity with diffeon and dilaton perturbed in like some messy way, and actually the result is the same. So, and that's one indication that things are working well. But again, I don't know anything, I mean, I cannot say anything about the f to the 6, and I mean, the problems with the symmetric space. I mean, this is neither confirming or informing. It is just exploring one regime when it's irrelevant, if those terms are right or not.
Did you say what the form x, y, and z is?
Yes, I had them here.
Are, but did you actually see what they're?
I had them here, so.
Okay, sorry.
Basically, z just has numbers on the diagonal. X is
okay,
like
good.
1 and minus 1 and rotating, and y is doing the same thing with a minus sign and with an I in front.
So x is proportional to sigma 1.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, it's
you
can actually multiply one by the other, and you actually get 1 when you multiply them.
It's the same x and y are basically the same up to pi.
No, I have a minus here.
There's a minus here.
Yes. Actually, it's not. So you can write them in terms of like raising and lowering matrices. This is how I have them in the paper. And
to me, on pan, it looks like if I multiply x times y, I get minus 1. If I multiply y times x, I get 1.
Let's see. Oh, but you also have an. a dagger minus a. I'm pretty sure.
The first row times the first column.
Mm-hmm.
One case I get one, one case I get one.
So it's actually specific, it's actually mm-hmm. It goes around, right? There's actually two elements in each row and column.
Well, you can't see that by what you've written.
Right.
Well, because, I mean, here there are two elements.
Right.
And actually, this matrix is infinite, so I mean, it's infinite all the way.
First row is two elements too, where's the last
element? Actually, I mean, I'm sorry, I should have actually made it.
You actually have the ellipses go infinitely in both directions, right?
But the dots are going in both directions. I mean, in the Z there, I made them, I'm sorry, this is like a wrong row.
Yeah.
So, there is an A daggers.
Where are the polymorphs?
It's infinite matrix actually, yeah, that's very important. I'm sorry I didn't make it more.
Right.
So it's dot here and dot here. Yeah, otherwise actually this is one of the reasons for which you made an infinite, and this is one of the reasons, for example, when you write this non-abelian Born-Infeld, actually the fact that the matrices are infinite, a lot of the traces would cancel normally, but since they are infinite they don't commute, so you actually have to be very careful and do it step by step. Yeah, I'm sorry for this. I mean they're bigger. Yeah, bigger matrices. Once you get this action, so again, this simplifies and one finds this Lagrangian, and from this Lagrangian one can find easily a string charge, which is proportional to dl d omega, and one can find a Hamiltonian which has this form, and then we can take the limit when the d0 charge goes to 0. The d0 charges are at distance l from each other, so we take the limit l times n equals constant, while this is like l times n is like the space of the periodic direction, while we send L to infinity. So if we take this limit, L times N equals constant and L goes to infinity, we find the potential, and it's going to be the Hamiltonian is going to be proportional to Q1, which is what one expects, plus R squared over Q1 times G string squared. So this is the Born-Infeld piece, and we can also find the Vesalino piece, H proportional to L4, and it's proportional to symmetrized trace of C0XY f, sorry, fxy, no, I'm sorry, 0xz, fxz plus c0yz fyz, and this is equal to f0xyz times n times r squared. With some, I mean, I'm ignoring all the alpha prime and so on and so forth. So this is, you see this and this both have r squared, both have this these factors, q1 and 1 over g string squared. So basically this is what the matrix description is, and this is what the results, those are the results. And again, we cannot find the f squared term, the last term, because those couplings are not known. I mean, in the matrix theory, people don't know how these couplings are working. One could actually think about turning the problem around and knowing that here we have a supersymmetric problem and try to find what sort of f squared terms should there be in order to complete the squares here. But I haven't given that problem so much thought. So let me go to the, so I have done these two. Let me go to the next stage, which is the supergravity description of this polarization. So let me first state the philosophy of this supergravity description. So we have a fundamental string. We have a large number of fundamental strings on top of each other, and we want to perturb the background with some field which polarizes the brain, which polarizes the strings into brains. The philosophy is the following. We can do a generalization of the ABACFT correspondence in the lines of Itzhaki, Maldacena, Senoshine, and Yankelevitz. What they have done, they actually look at all the near horizon limits of F strings, D brains, M2 brains, and all sorts of brains, and they generalize the ABACFT correspondence, saying that physics can be described by supergravity in the regime where supergravity is weakly coupled, and is described by the boundary theory, and I mean it's dual to the boundary theory. So basically, supergravity in the weakly coupled regime is dual to the strongly coupled boundary theory. And actually, they haven't done this case. They haven't done the fundamental string and with in type 2a. They have done the one in type 2b, which goes to the D1 and so on. But this one is actually it's quite a trivial exercise to generalize the IMSY construction to this fundamental strings in type 2a. And once you set up this ABACFT type correspondence, we know that if you turn on a operator in the boundary theory, if we include an operator in the boundary theory Hamiltonian, this corresponds to a non-normalizable mode in the bulk. So actually we want to find what? We want to turn on some operator in the boundary theory which corresponds to the non-normalizable mode which polarizes our brains. This is very similar to what Joel and Mass Trussler did with their, in the case of D3 brains. They actually turned on a formula mass bilinear. This corresponded to some H3 and F3 in the bulk, and this F3 and H3 polarized the D3 brains into NS5 brains and D brains and D5 brains. Here we want to turn on some field which corresponds to which can polarize our brains. Now what is this field? We have F0XYZ, and now I'll actually switch notation. I'll call XYZ, I'll just call them 1, 2, 3, because it's much easier when you do supergravity to have numbers. It's just, so this is 0, 1, this is 2, and this is 3. So F, 0, 1, 2, 3. We know by Hodge duality, or Poincaré duality, that this is F, this is the same. Having this thing non-trivial is the same as having an F6 with 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Also, this D2 brain couples. There's another term in the Wesolino coupling, in the Wesolino term of this D2 brain, which is B01F23. We have a non-trivial B01 to begin with, so actually there's also some F23, and if we have a non-trivial F23, again we can have polarization happening. So those are the two fields on the transverse space. Those are the two fields which we need to turn on. This transform both in the 28 of SL8. And they correspond to a fermion bilinear in the boundary theory. So fermions in the boundary theory, we have F4 strings that transform in 8C, both the left moving and the right moving, we are static gauge. And basically their product transforms in 1 plus 28 plus 35 plus. And this is one combination, so 28 is one fermion bilinear which has the form, let's say, if you make them complex, it's going to be like look like real of lambda 1, lambda 2 bar, for example. This transforms in the 28 of SR8. And so it's very easy to relate. If you turn on this formula on the boundary, we can easily relate it to the F6 and F2 on the bulk. And we can very easily then look up in the boundary theory and see how much supersymmetry is broken by this operator. This is quite an easy exercise. It's much easier than to do all the supergravity, to look at the supergravity to see how much supersymmetry we have. So,
could you just remind me, the theory on the boundary is what, a 1 plus 1 dimension?
It's a 1 plus 1 dimension theory which leads on a bunch of n coincident F1 strings. I don't know too much about this theory. I know it's called the orbifold sigma model, and it has been described by Degraft and Verlinde and Verlinde. It's quite an enigmatic theory. People don't know too much about it, but I don't know too much. I don't need to know too much about it. I don't have any interest in the boundary theory because it's quite. What I need to do is to get my supersymmetry in the bulk taken care of in some easy way. I mean, basically, I need to compute. So I'm using. In Polchinski's cluster, you use this construction to learn more things about the boundary theory, to see if it's confining, to see all these nice properties. Here, it's a mysterious theory. I don't know too much about it. I know, for example, the strong coupling limit of this two-dimensional theory actually becomes two-dimensional. Basically, this F1 string, when you go to strong coupling, the 11th dimension open up, this becomes an M2 grain. So this theory becomes a conformal theory, so with one dimension extra. So, I mean, it's a pretty strange theory. I don't know too much about it.
So, yes, in the supergravity solution, what's the dilaton doing at infinity?
The dilaton actually is blowing up at infinity.
So it really is, it does open up. It's not,
yes.
It's, so it's at infinity, which should be the mm-hmm. V. Mm-hmm. Not an F string, but it's an M2 grain. It's a wrap.
Yes.
So this is the M2 CFT, the thing that we talked about last week. But
mm-hmm.
with one direction.
So basically, as you go, basically see this direction opening up. So those are the fields. I will not bother you with how these things can be related. So let's write the supergravity solution for a bunch of fundamental F4 strings. They are just dx squared equals z to the minus 1, dx 0 squared plus dx 1 squared plus dx perp squared. The dilaton equals d string times z to the minus 1 half. And b equals z to the minus 1 times dx 0 wedge dx1, and z is equal to 1 plus n d string square over r to the 6 in the near horizon. I take this right away, and as Joel said, basically we can see here that we have z to the minus 1 half, so as r goes big, the dilaton increases, and actually we find ourselves in the M2 grain theory. It's very easy to do an IMSY, it's actually the solution in Yankelevitz analysis of this metric, and to see where supergravity is weakly coupled, where the boundary theory is strongly coupled. I will not bother you with that. Now we turn on this F2 and F6 perturbation, and we can find the equation for this, which this perturbation satisfies. It's not very hard. I mean, you can just take those and plug them into the supergravity equation of motion. You find d of z to the minus 1 star on the transverse space F6 minus F2 equals 0.
Are you doing it in the linearized approximation?
Yes, I'm doing it in the linearized approximation. I'm turning on some F, which is much smaller than this field, and I'm just perturbing. So I'm just doing the first order perturbation. Z to the minus 1 star 8 F2 minus F6 equals to 0. And you can see, this function, z to the minus 1 star 8 f6 minus star 8 f2 minus f6, is a harmonic function. And as long as the metric is of this form, z to the minus 1, z to the minus 1 half, z to the minus 1, as long as the metric has this black grain type of structure, this function is going to be harmonic. And as you know, in the ABS-CFT correspondence, this is going to be given by its value at infinity. So we have a harmonic function. The value at the boundary describes, this is given by the field theory, and since it's harmonic, its value is everywhere. That is that value everywhere. So this is going to be the same regardless of how F looks. Of how Z looks. So this is a very important observation. What it tells you is that when you want to compute this probe background, you have a D2 grain and some F charge, and the potential which this guy will feel will be actually independent on where the F strings are localized. And this is a very important fact which we'll use later. So from here, actually, we can find very easily the Wesel-Minow coupling of this probe over probe D2 grain, and this is just going to be equal to C3 plus B2 wedge C1. And actually, what's happening if you take a D of this? This is going to be equal to exactly this harmonic function, to the one here. So basically, these two. So basically, the Wesel-Minow term of the action of this probe D-brain is going to be independent on where the F-strings are. So if the F-strings are on top of each other, or if they're like far away in some directions, this Wesel-Minow coupling of the probe brain is not going to know that. The Wesel-Minow coupling of the probe brain is only going to depend on the boundary of this guy at infinity, which is given by the boundary theory. So that's number one. That's the first thing to remember.
I'm sorry, I'm a little confused with that.
I'm sorry.
Are you saying that you could set Z equal to 1?
No. So I have Z, I'm working in the limit when this is much larger than 1. So if I take the F strings to be coincident, I have this function, n over r to the 6.
Right.
If I have the F strings to be on 1 on a circle, I have another harmonic function. What I'm saying is that if they are coincident or if they are on a circle, the same thing is happening. I mean, basically you have the same, the Wesel-Minow term is going to be irrelevant. It doesn't care.
For any probes outside.
For any probes outside. Oh, also inside. Everywhere, I mean.
Inside it could be flat space.
Actually, no, because, so this is a codimension one disk. So this is a disk, or one dimensional, this is an S1 inside the R10. So it's not going to be, this is just like a one sphere. So it's not going to mess up with, how am I doing with time? So we can also find the let's assume we have a probe. So we have a bunch of F strings living here, and we bring in a probe D2 brain with also some F string charge, and we want to compute what the potential for this probe is. We have a spherical probe, and we just want to see what this probe is doing. Is it staying somewhere? Is it collapsing and so on and so forth. We saw that the Wesel-Minow term doesn't care where those F strings are, and the Born-Infeld term is actually not so hard. You can find the Born-Infeld Lagrangian. We just plug in these fields into the brain action, and from the Lagrangian we can find a string charge which is conserved, and from here we can find the Hamiltonian, and the Hamiltonian is going to be equal to 2 pi r times z to the minus 1/2 over g square root of n times g over r z to the 1/2. This is small n. So this is the number of strings in the probe. Z to the minus plus 1, this is square, minus n times g times r z to the 1/2. So this is the Hamiltonian of these strings, and you can see when the number of F strings is large, these two guys cancel. Basically, this represents the fact that F strings parallel to each other don't interact. So this is like the graviton and dilaton attraction and the two-form repulsion, and actually they cancel. And what we are left with, if we take the limit and we just cancel those guys, we are left with R squared over N times G squared. So you see, the Born-Infeld term doesn't depend on where the F strings are either. So the Born-Infeld term doesn't depend on where the F strings are. The Wesel-Minow term doesn't depend on where the F strings are. I tell you, we have supersymmetry, and therefore the last term is obtained by completing the square. So that the last term doesn't depend on where the F strings are either. And so basically, the potential of this probe, you can just bring in a probe. Its potential doesn't care where the other F strings are. So if we want to find the full potential, so we want to find the full self-interaction potential of a brain, of a probe brain with the M-strings dissolving it, we can just think about bringing one by one tiny probes from infinity and putting those together. Since they don't care of where the other F-strings are, even if they're on another D2 brain, actually this potential is going to be just the probe potential with the number of strings replaced by the other number. So this is kind of a fast, I'm trying to pull a fast one, so. Okay, one way to think about it is, I mean, just think of having a probe, and just think about splitting into like very, very tiny shells, very close to each other. So think about having one, and one here, and one here, essentially at the same radius. Each of them, individually, doesn't care where the rest of the strings are and what they are doing. So the potential for this brain is actually the same as the potential for, the potential for this chunk is the potential for the probe brain, and so on and so forth for all the tiny spheres. And so this is actually, so you can see that you get a total potential by bringing the brains this way. So basically the only conclusion is that the self-interaction potential of this disk is proportional, I mean it's just obtained by the probe potential by replacing small n with large n, where n is the number of strings. So up to here, this is all, this has been just the supergravity computation. Now we have to complete the squares. I mean, now we have to complete the squares in this potential and see what we get. Let me erase the potential here. Before we complete the squares, it's actually useful to make some to generalize the problem a bit. So instead of just assuming that this this disk which you have here lies in the 2-3 plane, let's actually take a more general orientation, and we can call these coordinates z1 and z2, and we can also generalize the potential for an ellipsoidal D2 brain. Is not very hard, but I mean it helps, makes the physics much more transparent. So let's assume we have this disk lying in the z1 and z2 directions. Those are just some orientations, and we can write, so the total potential equals the Born infant potential, which is r squared over n g squared. If you actually take these two orientations, z1 and z2, you'll actually obtain absolute value of z1 squared plus absolute value of z2 squared over n times g squared. And the Wolzomino potential is going to be real part of z1 z2 bar times m, where m is the coefficient of this field. M is telling me how much field I have turned on. I can call that f either. I mean either m or f is the same. So this is just proportional to f 0 1 2 3, which I have turned on. And the real part of z1 z2 bar counts because of the SO8 rotation properties. So I mean, this is obtained by linking the Fermion bilinear with a boundary field, and we have from the supersymmetry analysis of the boundary theory, we have four supercharges. We have or eight supercharges, depending. I mean, in some cases you can have eight, you can have four. So this potential is a perfect square, comes from a superpotential, and it's very easy to just write down the last term of this potential. It's just going to be m square n g square and z1 squared plus z2 squared. So, and I can write this in a nicer shape. It's like 1 over n g squared times z1 minus z2 m n g squared plus z2 minus z1 m n g squared. So, if there's anything which I wanted to take home out of this talk, is this formula. This is the potential for this. This is the polarization potential for this probe. For this probe brain, it's obtained by, so these two terms are computed, and the other term was obtained by supersymmetry. And you can see it's a very interesting, result. It's a very interesting phenomenon happening. If n times g square is equal to 1, then z1 equals z2 gives you a flat direction of this potential. So basically what's happening for n times g square equals to 1, any vacuum with z1 equals z2 is a vacuum. So we have a moduli space of polarization vacua. We basically, we can have this brain having any radius whatsoever. It can have this radius, this radius, this radius. It doesn't, the potential, I mean, there's a zero potential for the brain to be larger or smaller. And this is like the moduli space of polarization vacua, and this is what I call scissor, because it's quite a nice thing. And for this guy being different from 1, if this guy is different from 1, then actually you don't have anything. The vacuum is given by, if this guy doesn't square to 1, you don't have, the only vacuum you have is at z1 equals z2 equals 0, which means no polarization whatsoever. So if this guy is either bigger than 1 or smaller than 1, you don't have any polarization. Then for this particular value, you have a whole moduli space of polarization vacua opening up. So you can have all this polarization.
The radius or in the shape also?
The shape is also, I'm saying it has to be circular, because that's z1 equals z2.
Okay,
it has to be,
so
cannot be.
So it's,
yes, Sorry. So you started off at the very beginning with the motivation that this was going to be like this Myers effect, and people think you have something and you're going to blow it up. And now you're saying that you don't have any preferred radius?
Yes, there's no preferred for this.
It stays together, or it can be any radius at
once? It can be any radius at once, yes.
Now, of course, if you didn't turn on any four form, and you just...
Then it just stays together, and you can go on the Coulomb branch.
You can get any radius at once also, right? Because it's just a bunch of parallel fundamental strings, and you can
yes.
put them at any radius.
Absolutely.
So nothing has changed.
No, but here, the thing is, here they have also, they polarize. Here they actually have D2 brain charge. And the D2 brain charge is larger and larger. So this thing, I mean, if this guy has radius 5, I mean, basically there's like a whole circle, I mean, there's a D2 brain living there. There's a D2 brain charge of this object, and it can be as large as it wants. So it's actually not just going on the Coulomb branch, it's polarizing. It's a completely different physical state. And this is the thing which is very funny. I mean, usually polarization, when you have polarization, you actually get some radius, and if you turn more field, you get a bigger radius. If you turn less field, you have a lower radius. But here, actually, it's very funny. If you turn a small field, there's nothing. The field is not strong enough to pull you out. If you turn a very large field, actually what's happening is that the back reaction kills you. Basically, that term kills you. If you turn a very large F4, it back reacts on a very large graviton, a very large dilaton, closes you up, and forces the brains to be together. And if you turn it just to the right value, which is this n times g squared equals 1, it actually has a flat...
You're not actually getting D2 brain charge, you're getting
dipole moment. Yes, absolutely, sorry.
You couldn't really increase D2.
Absolutely. I'm in that dipole moment, definitely.
I don't quite trust linearized analysis as far as it concerns moduli space. Because, for example, in the case I'm kind of familiar with, it's Pilgrim-Werner flow, it's very important to get to moduli space to have the exact solution to that. So the fact that you have, you know, this moduli space at a linearized level might not survive by nonlinear corrections.
Okay, I have
another,
two ways.
Another thing is, usually when you have moduli space, you have an enhanced supersymmetry. Do you see?
Enhanced supersymmetry or enhanced?
Symmetry. You have extended supersymmetry, right? So usually series with like in four dimensions with n equal 1 supersymmetry doesn't have modulus.
Actually, here I have n equals 2 supersymmetry in four dimensions. I actually have 8 supercharges. And this is actually the reason for which I believe this moduli space is going to be there and is going to stay there, because I have 8 supercharges, and generically theories with 8 supercharges have a moduli space. So
you have indeed extended.
So I have extended supersymmetry, and actually this moduli space is going to be there. I mean, it doesn't. What's actually more puzzling, if you can turn the problem around, what's more puzzling is that nothing happens for this guy different from 1. I mean, there's no moduli space whatsoever for smaller values. But I'm pretty sure that you can look at the range when the perturbation is smaller than the background, and actually you can find that for a very, very large range, the perturbation is just 1 over n of the background. So it's a very, very small perturbation. And you can see from here, I mean, n is the... So from here, you can see that the value which makes this thing happen is just f proportional to 1 over n times g string squared. And this way can be very small. I mean, you can have like a large number of strings, and you need a very tiny field. You need a very tiny f to get this moduli space to appear. And again, I believe it's protected because I have extended supersymmetry. I believe it's protected.
How you study the supersymmetry? Let's go back to that.
The supersymmetry is studied by looking at the boundary theory. So I have a boundary theory. It's a bit of a yucky thing. I can show it to you. You basically take a two-dimensional theory, fermions in 8C and 8C. You have vectors in 8V. You look at the supersymmetric transformations, turn on a fermion bilinear, see how many of those are preserved. I've done it. I mean, that's actually, this paper was ready like in August, in June, but they wanted me to really find the boundary theory and find the supersymmetry before putting it up on the web. So I've done the.
So you see supersymmetry just from.
Yes, I mean, you basically see the 16 supercharges, and actually 8 of them are dying and 8 of them are remaining. And it's a very clear computation. So let's see what else do I have to say. So the superchargers, I don't know why it is. I mean, the thing which puzzles me is like, why is it rare, especially at this value? As Alex said, I mean, there should be something has symmetry, and it's quite hard to tell. From the boundary theory, I think it's very hard to make any argument, because you have like you turn on some bilinear and you flow it up, and somehow for this particular value things are flowing in one way, and for other values things are flowing in a completely different way. And this part, and also I don't find anything physical with this value. I mean, I don't find anything. I mean, why is it n times g squared? And I mean, it's a very small thing, and it's there, but the computation is pretty solid again. And I mean, those two terms are obtained both ways. I mean, those two terms are obtained both using the matrix model, the non-abelian Born inside, and using the supergravity of this background. So I mean, there are two completely different computations and completely different approaches, and they give exactly the same thing. And the supersymmetry is quite thorough to check. And so basically, it's quite puzzling. So this is the main result. Hmm?
I think you can see the moduli space, but you can see a moduli space in a linearized approximation. What you can probably not compute is the metric on the moduli space. You find something like a flat metric on the moduli space. Right? Mm-hmm. So the metric would be correct, but probably you will see the moduli space even in a linearized approximation. Mm-hmm.
I see. What is that?
Have you looked at it from an
M3
point of view at all?
Actually, this is the next step, and this is the fun part of the talk. So let's try to imagine what's happening to this guy if we just want to leap this configuration to M theory. So we have this circle, this D2 brain, and it has a large F1 string hard on it, and there's no potential for this thing to have any radius whatsoever. It can have any radius it wants. And if we imagine increasing the coupling and looking up, lifting it to M theory, what we get, we basically get this spiral type of. So basically, the F1 strings just become M2 brains. So whatever F1 string charge you have, we have M2 brains rotating along the compact direction. So you have something like this. You have like, this is the F1 string charge, and then it spirals. I'm sorry, I'm really bad at drawing, and this thing is very hard to draw as well. So you basically get this spiral type of thing. And basically this in a compact direction, and the radius of this spiral is going to be the radius of this original configuration, and this spiral can have any length, any size it wants. So basically you have this spiral which looks very, very yucky, and it can have any size it wants. And again, and the funny thing is like this configuration preserves 8 superchargers. I mean, the boundary theory computation is solid. I mean, there are 8 superchargers, and they are preserved by this guy, and it can have any radius it wants. If you go to the limit where string coupling, if you go to the decompactifying M theory limit, actually this state doesn't stay there anymore, because basically these strings are very, very long, and basically they just, I think this state does dissolve into the Coulomb branch of this M2 brain, of this M2 brain theory. So if you just take an infinite 11th dimension, you actually don't see anything like that, because you need like this finite 11th dimension to have the ellipse in place. But so I think this is the M theory equivalent of this.
Do you understand eight superchargers better in M theory? Because you've only got one sort of brain there.
Mm-hmm.
And it might just be that the way it's wrapped around the circle is particularly mm-hmm. more symmetric than it looks like from the higher dimensional point of view. That's why I only put
mm-hmm. it. Maybe I haven't thought about it. What I'm trying to do is actually to find if to look at the background. I mean, the supergravity background can be very easily lifted to M theory. I mean, it's quite an easy computation. I'm trying to look at Mariana Grana, or I'm trying to look at to see if this background is supersymmetric and to see this supercharge is realized in the background on a supergravity background, and so on.
If you turn off external field, will it still be supersymmetric?
If you turn off external field, it collapses. It becomes...
But you said that the radius does not depend on the external.
No, it does. No, the thing is, if you turn it off, if you make it smaller than 1 over n times g square, it just collapses. There's no more... I mean, the potential starts increasing. So basically, the potential for this is... like it's square potential. And for this particular value of this field, it's flat, and then for higher values, it turns again up. So if you have this particular value of this external potential, it's flat, and this is what I have here. If you turn it, if you make it a bit smaller or a bit bigger, it actually lifts up, and there's no polarization whatsoever. Basically, the brains come on top, the strings collapse on top of each other. So it's actually very important that this value be the way it is.
How do I understand that relation? The dilaton, you're not saying the dilaton is constant.
Here? No. What relation?
Mm g squared equal 1. So what's g there?
G is the dilaton which I put at infinity.
The value, asymptotic value of the dilaton?
I'm defining dilaton to be e to the phi equals g times z to the minus 1/2. So whatever multiplies the harmonic function to 2 is geometric. I mean, I can do it like that. It doesn't have, I mean, it's not an asymptotic value because at infinity we open up into M theory. So at infinity things are changes. So I think that's it. Oh, one more thing. This the same type of phenomenon should be happening when one tries to polarize D4 brains into NS5 brains. It's exactly because the reason for which this state phenomenon is happening is because of the codimension 1. When one has a dimension 2 or dimension 3, you have different powers here. You have r to the 4, r cube, r square, or r to the 6, r to the 4, r square. Only when you have an object of one dimension higher, you have r square, r square, r square, and you expect this funny phenomenon to happen. So when one studies D4 goes to NS5, the same thing, the same type of potential is should be happening. So
in that case, you also have in the M3 picture only one type of brain.
Yes, the same is here. You only have M2 brain here. I think it has to do with what Oliver says. I mean, basically, this phenomenon is linked to the fact that you only have brains of one dimension difference when they come from the same brain in M theory. You don't have them just sitting there. So it's going to be just M5 brains of the same form. So this project is underway with Diana Vaman from Princeton. So that's more or less what. Yes.
Due to this configuration, this string in string theory, the spiral line being a string.
Spiral line being a string. I don't think. I mean, this is the M2 brain. So.
Where is the other directions of M2
brain? The others are. I don't think. I don't show them. I mean, this is like the 11th direction.
The other two are flat.
Sorry. The other two are flat. Yes.
Okay, so
the other two are just directions of the FR string. The FR string has 0 and 1. Sorry? Mm-hmm. And of the time also.
Can you get rid of spatial left direction?
I think so.
So this is also configuration saving type 2 string saving. If I don't.
You should, I mean.
Or not.
I guess, I mean, you can. I guess you can compactify and.
So this is a BPS state?
Eight supercharges.
Sure.
That's... If you don't believe me, there's a special thing again, I can show it to you. I mean, it's... I'm not telling any tricks. Okay, so I guess that's it.